City Affairs will please come to order. We have with us this morning, we have Representative Peterson, Representative Seaton, Representative Wilson, Vice Chair Wes Keller, myself, Bob Lynn. We plan to hear two bills this morning, SB 89, Legislative Ethics Act, and HB 254, Alaska Native Language and Advisory Council. Before we go into those bills, anything, any comments from anybody? If not, we'll bring up SB 89, Legislative Ethics Act. Will the sponsor please come forward? Good morning, Senator. Please introduce yourself and then give us a broad outline of your bill, the purpose for it, and then we'll proceed from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm Senator John Coghill from the North Fold of Valdez to Palmer District and have enjoyed serving them. And thank you for having this bill before you today, and thanks to the committee members. I'm hoping that you all got a packet of this some time ago. What I'll do is I'll start with the broadest overview of what we're trying to do, and then get down and drill into the specifics.
Okay, and then the reasons behind filing the bill.
Sure.
Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me, Representative Wilson.
I just wanted to make sure we're on version R.
You're on version R.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Please continue.
Mr. Chairman, I've been on the Legislative Ethics Committee for some time now, and in the process of being on the committee, it's become apparent that there are some places where things need to be clarified or processes need to be made better. And there's questions asked by members of the legislature of the Ethics Committee that really need to go to the legislature for answer, not to the Ethics Committee. They really are a committee that discerns how people act according to what our statutes line out, and quite often they find that they're right up on the edge of trying to figure out what does the legislature mean, or we can't go any further than what the statutes have authorized. So that is so I got tasked to actually carry this bill. This was not something that was generated out of my experience generally, except for the fact that I'm on the Ethics Committee. So this bill really does is two broad categories. One of them is I'll call housekeeping items. There are some things that are just going to be helpful to make the Ethics Committee work better. There are some things that are for better understanding that are kind of under the housekeeping. I'll give you one example. We, some years ago, talked about how much work we can do for constituents and what the limits are. And one of the limits that we found was...
Working for, you mean employment outside the legislature?
No, I'm sorry. I should have said working for them, and that is serving them as constituents. For example, helping them with OCS cases or helping them with permanent fund dividend cases, things that are really constituent work related.
Right.
Some years ago, we installed an administrative hearing process. And one of the limits that the... that we found was that when somebody is in front of an administrative hearing, that legislators really should not to advocate for a constituent issue in front of that committee. Well, then there were some reasons that we need to modify that issue. It gives us a lot more liberty than had been previously supposed because we tried to put time limits on it and things like that. I think we found a very good solution. But under the housekeeping part of this bill, what we said is if you're a lawyer and you're representing them, you should be able to represent them as a paid attorney before an administrative hearing.
Even though you're a constituent and you're in the legislature. If you're an attorney.
Right. If you're being hired for that purpose. Okay. And one of the other things is if, for example, you have been helping them and you're a witness to some of the facts within the case, that administrative hearing could call you forward to be a witness to some of those facts because you had been involved in them. And then one of the other things that we've talked about is if you were talking to a constituent and you weren't aware that they were in front of an administrative hearing, there is an excuse for that called ex parte that you didn't really know, but once you do know, then you become responsible. So that kind of falls into a better definition that I would call under housekeeping. There's another thing in this bill that says the Ethics Committee is to compile a list of the loans that you have to report. and they have had to keep that list, but so does our presiding officers in either body. And so rather than having them keep a list of those things, they would just, I think under this law, help us just keep a report of those lists so that I know that you've got them and we can point to the journal of either house.
And so you mean, Senator, the loans, for example, my house loan and so on, that we report on our regular disclosure forms?
No, these would be loans, for example, that you have with the state. If, for example, you were a fisherman and you were part of a revolving loan fund that you had with the state that should be disclosed, rather than keeping the whole report of that that loan, just the fact that you reported it, just a copy of the report that would point to the journal. And after this, you're going to go beyond my knowledge, and I'll have to ask Joyce to help me with that. But it is really kind of a much more of a housekeeping issue. Okay. Rather than keeping the compilation there, they just want to keep the report of that. And then the compilation is really in the record of the journal.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so would a loan to from Alaska Housing Finance be considered from a state agency, or that would be exempted, or?
I'll have to defer that to somebody who knows more than I do, Mr. Chairman. So under the housekeeping measures, that is just really, do they keep the whole compilation, or do they just keep the report of that loan? So also within this, Mr. Chairman, within this bill, we're up to this point, if you are a member on the Ethics Committee and you hear things that are confidential, us as legislators are required to keep that confidentiality. Up to this date, that has not necessarily been, that has not been true of the public members. Though I think they have, there is no requirement. So under the housekeeping measures, we find that we better include them under the same confidentiality requirements that us public legislative members are.
So in other words, somebody on ethics hearing, the public member, without this bill, they're free as a bird to put it on a billboard if they choose. Yes. But with this bill, that fixes that, same as for us.
Right. Highly unlikely, but the requirement's not there. So that's falls under the housekeeping measure. Under another thing that I would call under housekeeping is we have had a list of those who have to report under this Ethics Act, and the people that are employed within this building that deal with public policy, like the executive director and whatnot, are responsible. And we had begun to make a list of those who don't have to, who work in a building, people who handle copier machines and things like that. And so we started this list. It began to get pretty long. So we just, it was decided that it would be better if we just called them hourly employees who really are not involved in any of the policy work, but they are just in the work of keeping this building operating. So I think it was a better description. So I would call that under the housekeeping issues. There are some substantive issues in here that I think go beyond housekeeping, and I'll call them the more substantive issues. There have been questions on gift to charity events. We are under a prohibition of accepting gifts, except for under certain circumstances. And those circumstances are I'll describe in here. I'll show you the sections that we get through. But this bill kind of clarifies that a lobbyist doesn't give you gifts, except for some charity events, lobbyists are able to give up to $250. But not beyond. And it was not as clear in the language as we would like it. So we made it very clear that they cannot. Now, there are some people who can give gifts to legislators, gifts and tickets is how we clarified it, to charity events, but they must record, they must report that. And so up to this date, that's been that question on reporting. So this clarifies that there are exceptions to the gifts, and the benefit is really doesn't go to the legislator. It goes to a charity of some kind. We have allowed certain circumstances for lobbyists and certain circumstances for those who are not lobbyists. This is just better definition, and the gifts and tickets has been a question that has been asked the Ethics Committee a variety of times. This kind of clarifies that. there's the, oh, by the way, under those, what we said is, for example, if you're not a lobbyist and you're giving gifts, it has to be a sanctioned event by the alleged council, and the alleged council requires it as a 501c3. So there is an accountability and a reporting as to who gives that gift. So I think we made it pretty clear that if it's a charity event, it's reportable, but there is an exception to getting a gift, that legislators are usually under that prohibition of not getting gifts. Probably one of the new things is the policy called.
I think Reverend Seaton had a question. Was it on that point?
Yes, it was.
Reverend Seaton.
Is there a distinction in the bill between the lobbyist and the organization that the lobbyist represents? We've had this dichotomy for a long time, like the railroad brings around a poster. If a lobbyist gives it to you, it's absolutely forbidden. If the railroad gives it to you, it's okay. If there's a gift of travel committee going on, the cruise ship up here to Skagway or the railroad, you know, looking at those things, is there a breakdown in the bill on separating those two?
Mr. Chairman, what I'll do is I'll give the overview, and then I'll get down to that section. I'll show you how it breaks down for the various, what the exceptions are, and I think it'll become very clear that lobbyists, when they're involved in those things, are very, very limited on what they can do, and we're also very limited in what we can accept. So there's a whole list of those. I'm not modifying all of them, but I can show you the context in which they lay when we get to the bill.
What about things like your general reception where most of us, you know, are offered a basket?
Yeah, those have already been under the exceptions, and I'll show you those as we go forward. I'm not modifying any of those, and so, but I'll show you the context in which they lay.
Okay.
But I'm just trying to give you the overview right at this point. One of the new policy calls that you'll see as we get through the sections in here is the public members right now are appointed by appointed and confirmed by the legislature. At this point, there is no alternate available to the public members, but there are alternates available to the legislative members. And in order to make quorums, there have been real tensions on some meetings on being able to get public members lined up from all over the state to come to a meeting. And so the new policy call that you'll see in here is to add one alternate for the public members. And then they would be appointed just like the others by the Supreme Court Justice and confirmed just like the others before the legislature. And one of the additions to the requirement is for both the legislative and the public members, then if an alternate gets involved in a hearing that requires some confidentiality issue, that alternate member follows that issue to its conclusion. That way you have a kind of a continuity of issues. You don't have an alternate coming in and out of an issue. Once an alternate, both public or legislative, gets involved in an issue, they're now under confidentiality rules, and they are required at that point to follow that to its conclusion. So that's probably more under housekeeping, but because we're adding a public member, I wanted to bring that up. A new issue that we also bring up in here is on reporting of those gifts of travel or other gifts that we have. Right now, we're required to report them within 30 days, and that has become more and more problematic as you have some complex issues, for example, international travel. Trying to get all that information compiled and reported within that 30-day limits has become increasingly difficult. And the suggestion was to ramp that up to 60 days. It's still a reporting requirement, but it allows you kind of a little more flexibility in collecting information rather than reporting partial information with the hopes that you might be able to find the rest. This reduces the complication on that. One of the other things that we're doing in this bill is ethics training for those who volunteer. We more and more like to have volunteers for a variety of different reasons in the legislature, and there's an open question as to when and how we can use them, I suppose, because it's a leadership issue. However, once they have gone past the 30-day mark, we are saying in this law, they should do an ethics training course. And so they are handling issues just like you and I would in many ways. They should be under some of that reporting and the understanding. So we're requiring that anybody over 30 days be required to do an ethics training course.
Reverend Wilson.
When you say educational trainees, do you mean does that mean the interns? Or what do you mean by educational trainees?
The educational training would be to train them in the ethics law.
No, it says legislative volunteers and educational trainees. Who are the educational trainees?
If, for example, I have a Jordan Schilling right behind me, who is a UAF student. He's in education training, but he's doing an internship in my office. And so I think that would fall into that category. But there are some volunteers who will not be a part of that type of an internship who we may ask to volunteer. Like I say, that's an open question as to who they may be. But there are several internships. I think First Alaskans do an internship that is educational in its nature. But once they have passed a 30-day mark, it is wise for us, I think, to have them do the ethics training, to be aware of all the various different things that they may or may not be able to do, or be able to even help their bosses understand, you know, what the ethical issues on, for example, using government equipment. So that's kind of the overview, Mr. Chairman, and I can walk through each section if you wish.
Okay. I'd like to point out that Reverend Johansson has not joined us, and Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question on the volunteers. Is that going to include all our spouses? And 30 days, that's not a is that a continuous 30 days, or is that 30 days in a session, or 30 days in a legislature?
Good question, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, I'll have to take a look at that. And maybe this is the point where I could have Joyce come help me answer some of these more specific questions.
That would be fun. And I'd like to also point out that committee member Reverend Max Grunberg has an excused absence to this committee meeting. And before you begin, Representative Johansson.
Thanks. I just had some bigger questions to understand before we get into the detail, if you don't mind. First of all, on the legislator, like an attorney representing somebody in an administrative issue, which we're not allowed to do now, but that's correct. Are those relationships disclosed? So if the attorney who's not here, we'll use him because he's not here. If Max were to represent somebody in an administrative hearing and was being paid $150 an hour, would that be something that would be disclosed to the public somewhere?
Mr. Chairman, that's a close economic relationship that would be disclosed.
Okay. Thank you. If I can continue.
Mr. Chairman, if I could correct that. Joyce Anderson, administrator for the Ethics Committee. There is an actual forum that's called Representation for Compensation. Okay. And that would be attorneys or other people who are representing clients before any state agency, board, or commission, and they do need to disclose that, and that's disclosed within 30 days.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, so this administrative hearing portion is just not included in that, and we're adding that to this, and it fits right into what we're already doing.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. And then right now, staff, like our staff, can't get into an administrative hearing, and that's not changing. Once it goes to the administrative hearing, a non-professional is not allowed to get in the middle of that. Is that correct? That's not changing?
That is absolutely correct. In fact, these are the prohibition is there except for these three things, basically.
Okay. And then if I can continue.
Continue, please.
And then I just wanted to make clear the report of the loan, how that's changing. Now, if someone were to get a loan, ethics, you guys will have all the details still as today, term, amount, who it's with, et cetera, et cetera. And what's the change? Is the actual reporting portion just a boiled down version of that so we know it's there and we can go to ethics and see the big detail, or how does that really work?
Mr. Chairman, first of all, if on page 6 of the bill, starting on line 3, basically, and then maybe I'll have Joyce, but I just wanted to point out the place in the bill and then have the question answered by Joyce.
Through the chair, Representative Johansson. What we're doing here is we're doing some housekeeping. When a person has a state benefit and loan, and to answer Representative Seaton's question as well, certain state benefit and loans are required to be disclosed, and that is if they are awarded on a discretionary basis. So if they're awarded on a discretionary basis, we have a list of them in our handbook that we have worked with the state departments that require that disclosure. So when it comes to that disclosure, yes, it does require all the information that you have indicated. But the actual disclosure form itself is very small. You know, it just has the dates, the terms, and so forth. But there are only certain benefit and loan programs that need to be disclosed. Not, and you had mentioned, you know, or was Representative Peterson had mentioned, you know, like the getting one through the Housing Finance Corporation. No, that is not, because that's not a discretionary loan.
Okay. Follow up, Representative Johansson.
Follow up, and then I have one more question after that. So if I were to get an ADA loan and buy a building in Juneau and rent it out to a union, none of that stuff would be disclosed. That would just be because it's not discretionary. Somebody could actually do that, and that's perfectly fine.
ADA loans are required to be disclosed.
Okay.
And so what would you do? You would disclose that particular loan, and you would have the terms of the contract and so forth. And then what would be published in the journal would be sort of an abbreviated part of that.
And then just on that point, there's a list of what loans are reportable and which ones aren't, just so we kind of know. Like ADA is, and then you said HFC's not, and how do we know which is and which isn't?
Well, if you take out your handbook, which I have in a three-ring binder, there's a section in our handbook that is called State Benefit Loans, and it lists every department and every loan that is required.
Okay, thank you.
And we do a review every October and November with all the state departments, and we change those as either they're deleted or added or their terms change.
Okay. And one different subject, Mr. Chairman, if you don't mind.
All right. Representative Johansson.
Those were just informational, and this is one that I'm not too sure about. And it's the limitation on charity from a single lobbyist, and I want to understand how this works. So one single lobbyist could not provide me with more than $250 worth of tickets to anything, basically, under the charity, the things that are approved by exempt by Leds Council, I think, does it. I think that's what happens. So the only reason I bring it up is because it's charity, and I understand that we don't want one lobbyist, stuffing $10,000 worth of stuff into somebody's pocket so they get to go all to these events, right? I mean, I don't know if that's the intent, but just because it's for charity and it is should all be disclosed, I'm wondering if that's going to have an effect on the amount of money that's going to go to these organizations that we, through a committee process, approve in public and say we're going to do this golf tournament for whatever Farron Camp does for, I don't know what their cause is, but is that in any way going to limit the amount of money that's going to get into the hands, or are there just enough lobbyists with enough money around here that we can find somebody to buy us tickets? That's my question.
Mr. Chairman, this is to show that a lobbyist may give up to 250. So that's, I suppose, the subjective part of that is, could we find lobbyists to do that? This actually limits the legislator from accepting and a lobbyist from giving beyond that limit. So I think it's already been in law. This is just more clarifying. There had been some questions about that. And I'll defer more information to Joyce.
Mr. Chairman, if I could comment, lobbyists have always been prohibited, as Senator Coghill said, from giving a ticket to a charity event in a cumulative value of more than 250. What we're doing with this as well is we are opening it up to have other individuals other than lobbyists give tickets to you, which are over the $250 limit, and then that's where the disclosure that Senator Coghill mentioned comes in. So let's say the Alaska Railroad, instead of their lobbyist, could give you a ticket to a charity event that is worth $300. And because it's over the 250, which is what our gift limit is, then that becomes a disclosure within 60 days. We're making that within 60 days. So we're opening it up to include that. Right now, even the Alaska Railroad would have been prohibited from giving you a gift to a charity event that was, you know, capped at the 250. But we're opening that up for any dollar amount with disclosure over the 250.
And, Mr. Chairman, I might give one example. I think one of our representatives was honored at a particular charity event. I can't remember what exact charity event it was, but it was set at a head table where the cost donated for that head table way exceeded the 250 for all members sitting at the table. And but because of their advocacy, both privately and as a legislator, they were invited to sit at that table. But there was no lobbyist involved. It was put on by the charity event itself. And so, and it was obviously a fundraiser for a particular, I can't remember if it was cancer or Special Olympics or something like that, where they were, that was a lifelong issue with them, mm-hmm. and they were now sitting at this table finding themselves in a very difficult ethical position. And they were one of the spokesmen for that particular deal. And so it put them in a very awkward position. And I don't even remember how it went in the ethics committee, but that was the question. Beyond lobbyists, can they participate in charity events and have somebody give to the charity in their case? You know, so I think I explained that very well.
That's correct.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
So it's kind of the opposite of what I thought, basically. It's broadening it. Okay, and then can I just ask one more question? Was this whole bill driven from the perspective of the committee, or was it from the legislature, or a combination, or what kind of caused this to come about? Was it the public members of the committee, or was it from legislators who were involved, who saw things, or what was that kind of process?
Mr. Chairman, the issue was really brought by legislators who find themselves in an awkward position, and I can give you some examples. I think Special Olympics were one. I think Red Cross was one. There were, I think, Standing Against Rape was another. So there were many situations where people were involved in charity issues trying to raise funds, found themselves in some very awkward positions. And okay. So I think legislators in their advocacy, in their public and private life, were really put under pressure on this. So the question kept coming to the Ethics Committee, what do we do? And so we're trying to find out ways to allow them to do those without violating the public trust when it comes to lobbyists. I think that's the big issue, is just to clarify that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you. First of all, define for me, when we're talking about discretionary loans versus regular loans, define discretionary.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilson, discretionary loans are that there is no fixed criteria to award the loan. So in other words, they don't have that you, let's say it's an ADA loan or something or other, there are certain ADA loans that they don't have, that you have to have certain things and you meet these five criteria and then you are awarded the loan. They're awarded on a discretionary basis by the agency. And so that's where they become and I can't give you a specific example, but let me look at the list of state benefit and loans.
And Mr. Chairman, while she's doing that, one of the things that we have to be careful of is if there's something given especially to us because we're legislators, or a car loan that we might go through and get that anybody can get. I think if it's something that we get because we're a legislator, that's a reportable item. If it's not, so I think it falls out to the loan question. If it's that's so discretionary that not everybody in the world has the access to do that or fits that criteria, then it becomes special to an individual, and when you're a legislator, it becomes reportable. I think that's kind of the background part of that.
Give an example of that. I want to go out, buy a car, need a loan.
Anybody can do that.
So, but anybody can do that, as long as the loan interest rate and so on are not less than anybody else would get.
Right. you meet the criteria of that loan, and your creditworthiness and all that is examined. But if somebody was just giving you a car, and they would give you a loan without those criteria, just because you're so good looking,
couldn't be that.
Anyway, I'm sorry. I wanted to give you at least a background of why I think that it ended up that way.
I want to follow up.
Representative Wilson.
So, in other words, I'm still a little confused on this. So, I don't know of anybody that's going to give me a loan just because I'm a legislator. That's what I'm trying to figure out. You know.
Well, Mr. Chair, these are strictly only Alaska state benefit and loans, so they're only through the state. They're not such as a car loan or anything, but they're through the state. We've got, I'll just read a couple of them to you, and I'm not familiar with all these, but, you know, under the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development Loans, we have the Alaska Capstone Avionics Revolving Loan Fund, the Commercial Fishing Revolving Loan Fund, the Fisheries Enhancement Revolving Loan Fund, those kind of, those are a couple. And then we have probably 2.5 pages of loans from certain departments that have said that they're awarded on a discretionary basis. Does that help?
Yes. Okay. Now,
follow up
on a different subject. It's the 250 limit for a lobbyist. Now, I thought I heard someone say that if that lobbyist gives you up to more than 250, I thought it was per event. So I could go to this event, and if it's more than 250, I have to report it. I can go to this event, and if it's 250, I have to report it. But you're saying it's per lobbyist? So that lobbyist can't give me over 250 no matter what event? Answer that for me.
Mr. Chair, if I may, Representative Wilson.
Ms. Anderson.
If a lobbyist gives you a ticket to a charity event, it's cumulative within the year by that lobbyist. So if a lobbyist gives you a $50 ticket to a charity event, they can give you five $50 tickets, which are the 250.
Okay.
They could not give you the sixth ticket because that would have accumulated that amount. And if they give you one ticket that's worth 250, then that's all that they can give you for that year. Now, the lobbyist is required to report that on their lobbyist disclosure form as well. So there have been some times in the past, as just recently this year, where a lobbyist reported that they gave several tickets to a legislator, and APOC called our office to find out, you know, if this was in place, and it was. Well, then it was determined that the amount of the ticket that the lobbyist disclosed was really not that amount. You see what I mean? So they had disclosed the wrong amount, and it still was within the 250. So there is some sort of check and balance there. If they give you that ticket, they need to report that. You don't need to report anything, but it is cumulative.
Okay, and so it doesn't make any difference if you were invited to 10 charity events, you would have to have a different lobbyist give you the... I don't get invited to that many, so don't worry.
Exactly.
Okay.
On that point, Representative...
That's okay. I was just gonna say it sounds like Representative Wilson might have her papers looked at after those comments.
I'm just wanting to make sure I don't mess up inadvertently, you know.
Okay, Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I think I understand
you're gonna get audit.
That the gift is being expanded to 501(c)s as well as lobbyists. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Coghill.
The lobbyist is given a definite amount that they cannot exceed, $250, cumulative per year. But those who are non-lobbyists are now able to do that. But there's three very clear conditions. They must report it. It has to be a 501(c)(3), and it has to be sanctioned by the Ledge Council. So it's all very clearly reported as to who is giving, but they are able to give beyond the $250 limit.
Okay.
Follow up,
and just to be clear, then the lobbyists can only give those to sanctioned events and the $250 per year limit, but that's not expanding to the employer of the lobbyists. I mean, if they've got three employers, or three lobbyists each can give 250. Is that my understanding? Is the way this is written?
Good question.
Could you repeat that, Representative Seaton?
Yeah, let's say we have a company that has three lobbyists. Each lobbyist can give me a ticket for $250 to a sanctioned event. So that company could, depending on how many lobbyists they have, can, through those lobbyists, contribute more than $250 per year, as long as no single one of their lobbyists contributes more than $250?
Mr. Chair? Representative Seaton, yes, that's correct. So if an employer has three lobbyists, all three of those lobbyists can give up to $250.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That's interesting. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm sort of wondering who's in charge of setting the value of an event or a trip or a tour that, an organization might be giving to legislators. They send you on a trip somewhere, and they're saying the value is $249, so it's not reportable or something. How does the value, who sets the value of something?
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, are you talking about a gift to a charity event or just travel?
Well, I guess either one. I mean, who sets the value of a ticket to a charity event? Is it what other people pay? But if you're sitting in the front row, is that more valuable than the average ticket? And so is it, I can see that, you know, since we're legislators, we may get a preferable seating location or sit at the front table or a better meal or better accommodations than someone else. And so is it... I'm just trying to figure out how you set what the exact value on that, and who would do that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, as a matter of fact, the Ethics Committee is meeting on Thursday next week, and we will be issuing an advisory opinion on that very subject. This has come up. It has been a discussion through most of last year regarding that particular subject, and so we have a draft advisory opinion that will be heard. Any of you are welcome to come and attend our meeting next week. It's going to be at 9 o'clock on Thursday. And basically what the advisory opinion is stating is that the if we used an event called Shoot for the Cure, which happened last year, it was in the Valley, and they had you could participate in a team, and the lowest amount of the team, let's say, might have been $1,500, and it could have went up to $10,000. The committee is looking at the lowest value to enter that particular or participation, so we would go with the $1,500. Even though there might have been $10,000 for a team. And so the committee felt that that was the way to look at it, because that was what you could have participated if at the lowest amount. And I'm not sure the committee is going to agree with that particular draft, but that's what they're going to be looking at next week. So I don't want to say that's a fact, but that's what we're looking at. We're also had looked at gifts received at a charity event. Does that count as well? And they're looking at that particular issue, and they're saying that gifts received at a charity event are separate from the entry fee, let's say, to participate, or the ticket to attend that particular event. So as I said, we will be issuing that advisory opinion hopefully next week, and we will be sending that out in our newsletter with those particulars.
Okay.
And based on your question about travel, most often when you travel, there is some sort of a cost associated, whether it be hotel, airline, meals. There are, however, trips that are taken that don't have a value. And so basically what we would say is you need to come up with some sort of a the statute uses the, quote, fair market value. And so we would look at that and see if we could come up with some sort of a cost.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, please continue.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what I can do, if you wish, is I can go ahead and take the bill and just go through each section and to show where now what I talked about in broad terms actually lands in the statute.
Put it into language. Okay. Right. Do you have a question?
No.
Okay. Please continue. Good idea.
All right. Section 1 actually is where we just changed the word lawful gratuity to gift. That really is kind of a housekeeping. And then it talks about the exception under 080, which is the gifts of charity that we were talking about in another section here. So we'll get to that. So those, that is just a kind of a conforming section, section one.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I realize that it's not a change that you've made in this, but on page four, line four, we have a, you may not knowingly seek, accept, use, allocate, grant, or award public funds for a purpose other than that proposed by law, or make false statement in connection with the claim request, application for compensation, reimbursement, travel. I noticed that the word knowingly is left out there, whereas in most other places, like page 6, line 20, a public member of the committee may not knowingly make unauthorized statements. I'm wondering whether the whether that should be in there and be the same status of making a false statement, because when somebody is, I mean, I think that what we're trying to do is make sure that, just like with a public official, not knowingly unauthorized disclosure, we're in this case, we are making this bright line that if there's a inadvertent mistake, it's a violation. And I'm wondering whether that should be included in this redraft.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator.
From my perspective, I think it applies in both cases because it's knowingly seek or make. And I think that's how you would take that. You know, knowingly seek, accept, or use, or knowingly make a false statement. I think knowingly applies to both of those. That'd be my thinking. I'm sure open to Joyce's kind of interpretation of that.
Mr. Chair, if I may represent, see, I agree with that, and there actually is a definition of knowingly in statute. I have looked that up before, so I know there is one there, not in our statute, but in another part of the statute. But I agree, I think it applies to that whole section.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm glad to get that on the record that the Ethics Committee agrees that knowingly also applies to make false statements. So, thank you very much.
Senator Congo.
Let's see, where was I? Okay, section two, which starts on page five, is where we talk about the prohibited conduct and conflicts of interest. This is where the section starts off with administrative hearings and what you may or may not do in front of an administrative hearing. You know, you may not influence the outcome of this particular hearing, but if you're representing another person for compensation, section number two, sub two there, is acting as a party or a witness to the matter, or number three is an inadvertent ex parte. So those three things now we're adding to that as kind of the rule before administrative hearings and what you can do in representing. And I think we talked about what would happen if you're actually compensated and how that would be reported. I got clarified on that.
Representative Seaton?
Thank you. I just wanted to clarify, the statement was made that if you were a lawyer acting on behalf, you would report your clients. I thought doctors and lawyers were exempt from reporting their clients, the names of their clients. Am I mistaken in that?
Mr. Chair, if I may, Representative Seaton, our statute does require that they report that. So, and we have not had an issue with anybody questioning that reporting in the past. We've only had one individual in the past who has actually reported representation for compensation, and that former legislator probably reported maybe 10 or 12 clients that and did put the name of the client down and the board before which they were representing that client. So I can certainly look into that, but we haven't had an issue with that.
Mr. Chairman, if I might continue to answer that, if you look at Section 8, there is a new subsection in this bill that would deal with if you are somehow not able to make that disclosure, here's how we would handle it. So if you look in Section 8, and this comes up with that very question, both with people who have a client list that may be confidential, or if you're doing healthcare that may be confidential, this new subsection says a person may submit a written request to refrain from making this disclosure. So, but it has to be, would violate state or federal law, constitutional law, or a trade that has formally adopted a particular confidentiality issue. So we're giving them some out, but they still have to apply to the ethics committee saying in writing, we're requesting that this confidential information not be reported. So it's an accountability measure, but it's still a recognition that there are some places from healthcare to legal care where confidentiality may very well be needed to be disclosed. But the application to the ethics committee then says, I'm being accountable for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So that would be new under this law.
Okay. Thank you. Continue.
So then the state loans program, section number 3, deals with what we are talking about, maintaining the disclosure list rather than compiling the list, just actually making the disclosure and pointing towards the supplemental journals that carry that list. Section number 4 is, once again, it puts the public members under the confidentiality rule, which had not been previously done, which now I think now that we've looked at it, is only reasonable and right to do. So Section 5 now deals with that gifts. And so Section 5, the section that deals with that is on page 6 under A sub B. And this talks about the tickets to charity events. Remembering, and what if I'll just for the record, I think go back to page 6 and look, except as otherwise under sub A of that, provided in this section the legislator may not, and so they may not solicit, accept, or receive directly a gift worth $250 or more. So, I mean, there's a strict prohibition except for this gift to charity now. This still keeps the list for lobbyists, but it gives a broader reporting for those who are non-lobbyists. So I think that section we've talked about fairly clearly. Section
7, is it?
Well, actually, Section 6 has a conforming language section on page 9, line 15 and 16. A contribution to a charity event in connection with a charity event is in the reporting section. Gifts of hospitality in Section 7, then. This is extends the charity event. Let's see. This is this under reporting, or is this definitional?
Section 7, right?
This is under reporting section.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Before we go on, I think I read it in here someplace, but except as otherwise provided, the a legislator may not solicit a gift. Now, is that meaning a gift to themselves, or I think there was an exclusion so that legislators could solicit contributions for auction at charity events or something like that in here, but I'm not able to find it. I just want to get on the record whether this section, page 6, line 27, means that legislators cannot solicit contributions for charity event things to be auctioned at charity events. I think that's other than a gift, but I'm not sure.
I'm going to defer to
Mr. Chair, Representative Seaton. In another part of the statute under 2460.030, there says that legislators may solicit and accept contributions for a charity event, because a contribution to a charity event is not considered a gift.
Thank you.
Not under the gift section.
Just wanted to get that clarification. Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
As you can see, Mr. Chairman, I'm slowly working my way into understanding the breadth of this law, because
so first we pass it in
030 is a big section of law of the do's and don'ts.
Keller had a question.
Thank you. Before you continue, that section 2, I want to go back to that just a little bit. Been sitting and thinking about it, and administrative hearing is not defined here. Was not defined. And is, do you wonder if there's a would be I'm asking the sponsor if there'd be any wisdom in referencing the statute that defines the administrative hearing, because I was just thinking about a case that I have a constituent where I asked for, it wasn't officially an administrative hearing, but I had an administration there, and you know, there were some decisions that were being made, and I got a little uncomfortable. I don't want to give a lot of details on it, but I'm just wondering, a little background if I could. I'm concerned that there's not much there anyway between if there's an excess in the agency and our constituents, and it seems like we're the only ones standing in the gap sometimes, you know, and I just want to make sure this is as narrow as it should be, you know, so that it isn't misinterpreted as saying, okay, I can't go in there and make a case for my constituent in front of somebody in the administration, you know. And so my question is, should we reference this to a statute?
Either one.
Well, you know, one of the things that has been kind of a growing issue in Alaska is administrative hearing. Generally, we actually have an administrative law judge now, which is probably, what, 8 years in the making. And there are some places like workers' comp where you're going to go before.
Bring the microphone up closer, please.
There might be places like workers' comp where you're going to go before an administrative hearing that is more akin to a tribunal. And so I think that's what's anticipated in this. A hearing officer assigned a board or commission with the authority to make a final decision is kind of what we were heading at for definition. So we do have administrative law judges, but we also have, for example, the dental board actually has disciplinary action to dentists. And the question is, should we go to bat for a dentist at that board when they really are going to have legal counsel? And so I think that was where we were trying to say is, we're not really their legal counsel, we're their legislator, and we're advocates for them generally, but to advocate for them specifically in a matter of law then starts to get into that area where we might be stepping out of our bounds. So it's probably not as tight as many would like, but that's the best definition I think we can come up with.
And probably just putting that on the record is enough. I mean, I'm not trying to...
And I'll defer to Joyce on this because she's probably had more questions on this right. than I have.
But I could give information to the attorney representing a constituent in one of these hearings. That'd be a little indirect, I guess.
Well, the point is we're not to use our power as a legislator to overly influence the decision of one of these hearings. I think that's where we're trying to say your authority as a legislator is to be a servant and to be a help and to be an advocate. But there comes a point where that overuse then can be not constructive to good justice. And I think that's – it is true, though. I agree with you that there are many times where administrative action, because of the rules, can be very arcane and sometimes very unjust. Mm-hmm. And I think what we do is we find out where they might be unjust and advocate to the rule change, but we have to be careful on advocating before that administrative hearing, whatever it may be, to influence the outcome of that particular issue. So that's something we got to watch.
Somebody down here wanted to speak.
Mr. Chairman, I actually had my staff, who is right up on top of things, so I have actually... under section 4464-200 being passed out to you right now, the definition of administrative hearing, administrative law judge, agency, hearing officer, and office. So they actually are defined, and that may help all of us in the process. So, Mr. Chairman, and I will, I will defer to the committee on this if you want to find a place where we can actually add that in. However, if we have the question before the committee, remembering that the committee itself is a ethics committee and actually are going to be making decisions based on sometimes a nuance, they would probably go look into this issue if somebody is charged with an ethical behavior. So be that as it may, you'll have the definitions now, and I'll leave it to the pleasure of the committee.
Thank you. Representative Johansson.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, you brought up an interesting point about the amount of help that, as a legislator, you said, well, we could just help the attorney get all the information they want. That made me a little bit uncomfortable, and I just want to throw that out there to think about. I don't know how you would possibly deal with that, but, you know, on the Senate side, it's easier to find a member who's not an attorney. I mean, there are a lot of attorneys over there. So if I were to go to one of the attorneys in the legislature and said, hey, here's my problem. I'm going up against the administrative hearing. Talk to my attorney. You attorneys get together. This guy's going to get all the information that you can pinpoint your argument, and you're going to be influencing, as you say, more than you think you should. Is that just something we just can't deal with? I mean, I don't know how you would possibly do that, but it seems like a constituent could certainly get an edge in an administrative hearing if they were working with their attorney and a legislator, et cetera, just based off the comment of the chairman.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think the intent of the law is, there's always ways to game the system, I'm sure, but the intent of the law is to make sure that we as legislators are using our authority correctly for constituent work, because that's what the issue is here. What we do within our members, I think there might be some question there, and maybe worthy of a deeper question, but this is dealing with, I think, constituents' work and what you may be able to do up to the point of administrative hearings. So can you talk to the lawyer? Probably can. Can you instruct the lawyer? You know, I think, once again, at that point, the question is going to come out, are you attempting to influence the outcome of this particular hearing? And you're getting right up to that question that I think you need to be careful of, because it says that you may not attempt to influence the outcome of an administrative hearing by directly or indirectly contacting or attempting to contact. So I think by going to any one of the counsel on that particular hearing is unwise, because I think you're in danger of an ethical breach there. So I think that shows that clarity. But the nature of the world is a lot of us know friends, family, and counsel. Just be aware that if you're going to try to influence the outcome of the hearing, directly or indirectly, you're now putting yourself in a position where you might be unethical in your behavior and be able to be charged accordingly. So I think that's something we need to keep in mind, whether it's a colleague within the legislature or a constituent. I think we'd find ourselves
Well, I can tell you, I'm going, you know, an elected official, public figure, we all are, walking into a hearing, we're recognized, you know, for our position, and that could, in fact, influence the hearing people. That's a little bit different than talking to someone's private attorney.
But Mr. Chairman, we all have been on committees where we have, in the most forceful terms we can bring to bear, stood for our positions. I have been among those, and we're used to doing that. But when it comes to constituent work, we can, as forcefully as we can, encourage the administration to treat them fairly. But once they get before an administrative hearing, that is to be where the determination of fairness lies. And so I think for us then to push beyond that puts us in a position where we're trying to unfairly manipulate, and I think that's what we're trying to say here. And that would be true among legislators or among legislators to their constituents, in my opinion.
Let's press ahead to the next section.
Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, Representative Peterson.
On that point, and so it's up to Representative Coghill, to the legislator to tell the constituent, listen, this is as far as I can go. I can't cross this line. I know you would like me to do that, but that's not my job. I can't legally, ethically do that. So we have to know where the line is and communicate that to the constituents so that they don't have expectations that aren't realistic from their representative.
And Mr. Chairman, that is exactly right. And one of the reasons why we take ethics training is to make sure that we're using our position of trust very ethically, properly. And the constituents may want us to act on their behalf desperately, and for probably sometimes very good reason. And so we just need to be aware that what systems we set up, we need to let them work. But if we see that the system isn't working, it's our responsibility as policymakers to come change that policy. And I think that's where we can argue with all the force we can bring to bear.
But there would be a situation in which the administrative officer would call in or de facto subpoena legislator to come in and give their side of the story.
Well, that's what this law, Mr. Chairman, proposes, is that if you are a party to or a witness to something that that administrative hearing needs to know because of your involvement, maybe even in as a constituent worker, as a legislator, that that information is so helpful that they can actually have you come before. We want to give you the freedom to do that. Right now we have a prohibition to that. This new law would actually say, okay, if the administrative law hearing wants to know because of your involvement in this, some of the details for witnessing to that fact, then you should be able to do that. And then just in case you talk to somebody, as Representative Peterson said, and you didn't know that they were in front of an ex parte, you have to have some flexibility. You may have given them some advice that you didn't know at this point that they were before a hearing, which could very well happen to any of us. So we need to have reason for us to be genuinely concerned about our constituents, but not overly influential when they're before this really.
Representative Seaton, and then we need to press ahead. We have another bill behind this one. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If there's confusion on the administrative hearing, what that entails, and where things are, I haven't served on the Legislative Ethics Committee. Would it be helpful to have, after the administrative hearing, insert this definition? Because this definition is for 44, Chapter 44, not AS 44, not 24. So would that be helpful to the Ethics Committee to have that in there so that everyone knows what it is instead of the Ethics Committee having to make a determination on a case-by-case basis?
Mr. Chair, I'll go ahead, if I could, and read the definition, if you want, or do you have it there?
Oh, I have the definition.
Yeah,
but
read it, because it's, I think it's good.
Well, the definition is here, but if we want it, that's under 4464-200, administrative hearing means a quasi-judicial hearing before an agency. It does not include an informal conference or review held by an agency before a final decision is issued or a rate-making proceeding or other non-judicial public hearing. And it just seems to me that if we want legislators to know what they can do, we don't want to have the Ethics Committee having to reinterpret what a administrative hearing was. And it just, but I'm not, haven't served on the Ethics Committee, so I'm wanting to get the opinion before we.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Coggio.
At this point, I don't see any reason why we couldn't reference AS 4464-200 in this and amend it to this Section 2 somehow. I don't see any problem with that because it does point to what we would count on as a definition. So I think totally within line.
So when the time comes, you may.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can I ask you?
Johansson?
Thanks. You want to move on with the bill, but I don't. Is the intent to hold on to this? Because if we're going to try and move it today, then I really want to get questions out. Otherwise, I can wait until the next hearing. I don't know. You mentioned we need to
hurry
up.
We'll see how far we get. I would like to hear some of the next bill, but we're not going to push it forward. We don't. This is not that time sensitive, I don't believe.
Mr. Chairman, we have until the end of the legislature, although we're a third of the way in. But I think if you're going to entertain this amendment, having that in a formal form, I'd like to have the opportunity to think through how that might fit in here best, get an amendment proposed. So, I'm open to discussion.
You don't feel it's necessary to move it today. Okay? Let's go a little bit longer. Okay, I do want to. Some folks I see coming in, I believe, for the next bill. Edward Johansson, anything further?
No, if we're going to hold on to it, I can keep my questions till the next time.
Okay. Continue, please. Representative Wilson.
I still have a question about the administrative hearing itself, but I can wait to another time.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, at your pleasure, we'll try to answer everything we can today.
so that we can bring it forward with maybe a simple amendment and move on.
I'd like, I don't know if we can make it, how long would it take to go through section, where we are through section 15? I'm trying to pace this here.
The we can go to section 8, which I've talked about previously, and it would take us maybe another 6-7 minutes to go through the remainder of the bill.
Okay.
And just give you kind of the idea of where we're at.
If we can, I'd like to go through all the sections, and then,
all right.
And then at that point, we'll come back at another hearing and enter into a discussion after you've seen all the sections. Is that satisfactory to everybody? Okay, please continue.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 8 is that new subsection that we talked about, given written application to the Ethics Committee if for some reason confidentiality needs to be held on names or things that might violate federal or state law or a trade profession, and I'm thinking particularly of health care issues, but there are others. Section 9 now begins to deal with a volunteer who needs educational training, volunteer and educational trainee, which is deals with either a volunteer or now our interns, that if they work for over 30 days, that they would be required to do a ethics training course. And then the references in Section 10 are the technical section, or a technical site for Section 12, same thing with Section 11, technical citation for Section 12, so I can go right to Section 12, which deals with alternate members. This actually gives the right of the Chief Justice to appoint an alternate member subject to ratification, just like others by the legislature. And this goes to that question I was asking earlier about a quorum, and it also goes through the requirement that they also be included in, once your alternate member is involved in a discussion that has confidentiality, they follow it to this conclusion. So,
Mr. Chair, if I could just interject, we have two quorums that we have to meet. We have a quorum of public members and a quorum of legislators, so that we have a complement of both. So I just thought I would add that to.
Yes. To good point. Thank you. So this would actually help that. And it is true that these ethics members who are public members really do have to travel. We have one from Nome, one from South Central, you know, one from Juneau. So Section 13, once again, is about adding volunteers and interns to the ethics training requirements. And so I think pretty straightforward. This deals with the ethics course itself. Section 14 deals with the legislative employee. Remember, I talked about instead of keeping a list of those who don't have to report on ethics, we just said, okay, they'll be hourly employees, and that was on line 22 and 21 of this bill. It makes it clearer, and it makes it easier for, I think, those in the legislature to administer it. The Section 15 is a repealer. This is the process for appointing alternates, and I think what we did was we reinstated that, saying they are appointed, first of all, to the duration of an event plus the new public alternates. So.
Yeah, fine. Representative Johansson.
Thank you. Just as a heads up for next time the bill's up, I just want to really make sure that we define hourly employee and what we're talking about. It looks like you're talking about the people who make the building run, but I want to make sure that it's very clear that we're not having anybody who is influencing or working on policy decisions that are exempt from this. I just want to make sure that's very crystal clear.
Mr. Chairman, if you look on page 13, it says who are hourly employees perform functions that are incidental to legislative functions. So I think if, for example, somebody who was an hourly employee that was working on things that were beyond incidental and there was a need to bring them forward, and if somebody brought that forward to the Ethics Committee, it would be very clear that it was beyond incidental and that they should be. So I think this is to try to keep those who really are incidentally involved in the legislature.
Yeah, report.
Otherwise, if they're involved in policy questions, I think that's going to make it very clear you need to be reporting.
Okay.
So that's how I would take it, and I would certainly ask for any backup on that.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add, we're talking about hourly employees, some of the individuals that may be here recording the minutes of the meetings. Those are hourly employees. We have some hourly employees that just work in the maintenance department, as you alluded to earlier. Those are the types of employees we're talking about.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Johansson.
Thank you. I just want to bring that up because there is an option for us as legislators to hire people hourly, and I want to make it crystal clear that we don't have staff that is exempted from anything just because they're hourly. So I just want to put that on the record. I understand what your position is, but I wanted it to be put down on paper that that's very crystal clear.
Right.
And, Mr. Chair, if I may add, that is very true because we would look at those employees, and I have had questions about that. They don't perform functions that are incidental, so they are attending training.
Thank you.
And, Mr. Chairman, throughout this title, actually, legislators and legislative employees are included in almost all reporting requirements.
Okay. And what I'd like to do in just a moment, what I'd like to do before we move on to the next bill, I'd like to go down the line. Anybody who would like to have the sponsors of the bill look at before we have the next meeting, or give it some direction. Okay. Representative Seaton.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make sure that in Section 9, that the definition, whether it includes spouses or not, 30 continuous days per session or per legislature, is okay. Worked out for next time.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Wilson, did I get you before? Let's just go down. Representative Peterson, anything you'd like them to take a special look at before we meet again on this bill?
I think we've touched on everything that I can think of at this point.
Okay. I think you've already spoken to it. Representative Johansson, any specific direction you'd like?
I had something, but I can't remember what it was. I'll come up with it before the next hearing.
Rick Perry moment.
No, please don't say that.
President Wilson.
I'm fine.
I'm covered, thank you.
Okay. I'd like to thank you for bringing the bill forward. It's a very important aspect of what we do here. The whole bill is about really protecting the public. That summarizes the bill as far as I'm concerned. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Okay, I'd like to thank you for coming forward. Please work with the various members of the committee that have concerns, and we will attempt to reschedule this bill as soon as everybody is ready to go with it again, and hopefully that will be within the next week or so.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you for coming in. I'd like to ask the sponsors for HB 254 to come forward. At ease. Before us, House Bill 254, the title of which is an act establishing the Alaska Native Language Preservation and Advisory Council and relating to the preservation, restoration, and revitalization of Alaska languages. We have before us sponsors of the bill. Would you please introduce yourself? Just first give us the broad overview of the bill, and then we'll get into some of the particulars.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Representative Alan Dick, and I'm really pleased to sponsor this bill. The Alaska Native languages are threatened by extinction. Intent of HB 254 is to preserve and maintain these languages. The indigenous languages are the most critical components in preservation of cultural ideas and traditions and serve as the backbone of all cultural elements. The purpose of this bill is not to restore the languages, but to initiate an intelligent and a dialogue in regards to whether that should be done, and if so, how it should be done.
Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No problem.
My helper here was telling me where I am, what day it is.
There we go.
Go ahead.
I'm really happy to present this bill because my wife is the youngest fluent speaker of the Dunaina dialect of Athabascan languages. And my wife, as you know, is 66 years old. And for the 3 years previous to coming to Juneau, I administered a endangered language grant for the Alaskan Native Heritage Center. And so my wife and I have worked very closely trying to video document and come up with strategies for restoring and revitalizing not only her language, but the other native languages across the state.
Let me get this straight. She's the youngest member who speaks this language
fluently? She's the youngest fluent speaker of the Dunaina dialect of Athabascan.
Okay, and nobody younger than her, so...
It's nobody younger than her is fluent.
Okay.
Okay. And so we've worked. I've spent hundreds of hours in meetings and conferences trying to develop strategies for, you know, how to bring the language back. And for decades, the Native Alaskan people have been telling us that it's important for them to establish healthy communities, and the language is an important part of that. And for decades, the Native people have been telling us that the language is fundamental as to who and what they are. And that without the language, that there's a huge piece that's missing. And for decades, we've in the schools, we've given a small attention to it, but we haven't given a focus to this. I was learning the Yupik language before I married my wife back in the late 60s. And once I married her, my Yupik lessons stopped abruptly. But
but you're Dunaina.
Yeah, my wife. Ellen speaks Dunaina. Dunaina.
It's convenient to say sometimes she says, do the dishes, and you say, I don't understand.
Yeah. but after I married my wife, I was really challenged by the complexity of the Athabascan language. And so it's not a matter of just learning nouns and doing word substitution. But I can, even with my limited understanding of Yupik, I can tell you that there really is a part of the worldview that's built into the words and the way the words come together. Shakespeare used quite a bit of onomatopoeia, and yet I don't think that he could hold a candle to the native languages. And, for example, in the springtime...
You'll have to define that word for me.
I'm about to.
Okay, good.
In the springtime, the willow grouse will sit on a log, and they'll drum their wings as part of their courting ritual, and they'll dum 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 dum, and you can hear them out in the woods. It's like an old... Yes, sounds like an old...
I'm not flirting back. I'm just...
It's like a old inboard engine just starting up again. And so the natural word for the willow grouse is dum dum dock. And that, so onomatopoeia is where the word sounds like what it is or what it does. And anyway, so the whole language is just full of these references where the word is actually what it is and what it does. Yes. And if you knew the birds out there and the animals, I bet you know what a chikabibek is. And if you were out there and you lived out there, you know what David Dubberg is. And because they are what they sound or what they do. And there's even some pretty descriptive terms, like one bug is the one that drags his butt across the ground. And anyway, there's some comical, there's some interesting, fascinating, and very descriptive words that... English isn't able to, you're not able to do that in English, and I'm failing to do that here. So it always amuses me when I hear people say, well, why don't they teach the language at home? And I say, well, if I could ask that question another way, why do we teach 12 years of English in school? Why don't we teach that at home? And the answer is, we teach 12 years of English, so although we might know it, we might become more proficient, more accurate, and we all might speak the same English and not... have a massive amount of dialects in the United States. And so we know that in times past that the Native people were beaten for speaking their language. And we say, okay, well, that's past, we don't do that anymore. But I don't think we realize the implications. I was sitting at the kitchen table in Bethel with my friends Joe and Nancy Iagaruk when they read in the newspaper that the Alaska State Legislature declared that English was the official language in the state. And my friend Joe just hung his head. He said that hurts. Because what it said was, is who he was and what he was wasn't official. It wasn't endorsed. It was actually, he had to do it on the side. And when he gets together in meetings with the other Chupik and Yupik people, that they, their language isn't the official language. And I don't, I know the legislature didn't intend that. And I talked with legislators. Well, that isn't what they meant, but that's how it came across. And 3 days later, Joe was sitting at the table and he said, that hurts. So, although we think it only happened in the past, I gave that as one example of how it's an ongoing process where we assume that everybody either is like us or wants to be like us, when in fact we have some very unique people across the state. So, we've wrestled with the issues of revitalizing languages. And there's not easy solutions. The Athabascan languages, there's many dialects. But this bill isn't asking for to bring languages back. All this bill is calling for is just, do we have a respectful dialogue in regards to should that happen? People ask me, I said, well, isn't the university doing this? And my answer to that is, I think the university has done a fantastic job of preserving the languages, documenting the languages. There's people like Dr. Jim Carey and Jeff Lear, and let me tell you, those guys don't breathe the same air we breathe. I mean, they're out there somewhere. They, when you hear them talk, it's like, it's amazing. I mean, I don't know, I didn't mean what they're saying. I recognize if, but, and, and the. I mean, they really have a dark, they're experts in their field, but they're not revitalizing, they're not restoring the language, they're documenting them so they will be there. So, again, I believe this bill is about communication, but I believe this bill is also communication. It says we're listening. It says we take you seriously. It says we believe that you know and admit that we don't know what's necessary. I think it's a long overdue humbling, and it displays our willingness to listen. Thank you.
Spoken language began, I guess, millennia ago, eons ago, perhaps. The first human language. There have been thousands and thousands of languages that have come and gone and now extinct, except perhaps in scholarly, Latin would be one of the, everybody, that was a lingua franca at one time. I guess, suppose English is now. But all kinds of languages have become extinct over the years. They come and they go. We respect the language, but how does that relate to what you're trying to do here? I'm not expressing myself well. I'm wrong. I have trouble with the English languages as well as the near extinct languages. Do you see where I'm trying to go with this?
Well, I absolutely, and I agree that there's some language that might need to just pass away and fade away.
What about the people who spoke the culture of those languages, people who spoke those languages?
Well, we can always look at the Jewish language where it wasn't spoken for hundreds and thousands of years and where it's now come back. And the Irish language where the people realized that when their language went away, that a piece of them was taken away. And they made the effort to actually bring that language back again. There was a realization that that language was part of them and that language was them. And so they made that effort to bring it back. And you've even heard that the Iac language is actually finally extinct. But it's not. For some reason, there was another brilliant linguist in France, just like Jeff Lear and Dr. Jim Carey, one of those guys that are out there breathing different air. And he listened to tapes of the Iac language, and he's now become fluent in the Iac language. So we now have a Frenchman. I don't know if he speaks Iac with a French accent or not, but he is actually coming back to a developing lessons for the Iac people here in Alaska. I spoke with the folks in Cordova, and so that they can revitalize their language. It was that close to being lost, but a brilliant linguist has brought it back so that it can be recovered. And so, this bill, I don't think there's a huge fiscal note on this. We're not telling schools what to do. We're not mandating curriculum. But what we are saying is that we assume accept responsibility for being partially responsible for these languages not being a part of the everyday life of students and young people in these communities, and that we're willing to accept some of that responsibility, and we're willing to have dialogue in terms of what it would take to bring them back. And if we bring the people of those languages to the table, it I really believe it would be act of respect. And I believe even those of us who don't speak those languages would really benefit from hearing that dialogue. I think every one of us would, because there's issues there that I've heard across in the steam bath and other real confidential places that they're very personal issues with people. Like the example I told you about Joey Agarwal when he found out that his language was not the official language in this state. So,
okay. Let's go down the line here, and we have several folks in the audience who would like to weigh in on this, I believe. Representative Johansson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple things that I want to point out that I think warrant some discussion in the bill, and then I have a question. So I'm just going to throw a couple things out there. I don't know if this is going to be – the intent is to move it today. If it is, then I'll have a couple of amendments. But I need to, first of all, on page 2, starting at the end of line 17.
Page 2, line 17.
The very end, then 18 through 21, which says, in appointing the non-voting members of the council, the Senate President and the Speaker shall appoint a member of the Bush Caucus if a Bush Caucus exists, and it defines a Bush Caucus as a group of legislators that represent rural areas of the state. I have discomfort with that language. It's nothing to do with the Bush Caucus. It's just the fact that, you know, over the years, you have legislators who live in Anchorage who grew up in the village, move to Anchorage, get elected, have a much better perspective on what happens out there. You have people who grew up in the big cities. Former Senator Binkley is an example, who moved out to Bethel and was elected as a senator, member of the Bush Caucus. I think that the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House should have the ability to select anybody as they look at the 40 or 20 members and make a judgment on who would be best in that situation. So that's a concern, and I'm just putting it out there that I think that language should probably be taken out of there. And then one other thing that I have is in the same paragraph, it talks about the Governor shall appoint to the council established 5 voting members who are professional language experts who represent diverse regions of the state. And this is just an ignorant question. Do we have people that are professional language experts in all the regions of the state, or how does that work functionally?
I believe through the chair, Representative Johansson. In this state, there are in this state, there's been generally recognized as 5 cultural areas. If you would take the Southeast, the Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian as one, then there'd be the Iluktik and the Yupik, the Inupiat, and the Athabaskan. Of course, there's subdivisions of them. But I believe that's why the number 5 was chosen, that each one of them would have a representative. For example, within the Yupiks, there's also the Chupiks, and they would have to discuss that amongst themselves. Did you want to speak further to that?
Introduce yourself, please.
Mr. Chairman, Annette Kreitzer, staff to Representative Alan Dick. You have in your packets, I believe, an amendment that speaks to this section, and it was a concern of a few people who contacted our office and asked whether or not we could clarify what a professional language expert is and how that would be defined in the bill. And so I think at the time when the representative who's going to move the amendment moves it, we can speak more directly to Representative Johansson's question, if that's all right with the chairman, and if that's all right with Representative Johansson, take it up at that time.
Mr. Chairman, if I can continue.
Representative Johansson.
Yeah, I've looked at the amendment, and still, even with the new language, do those people actually exist, I guess, is my question, but... You know, and then if I may move on to another, my other question, bigger question, is what sort of efforts have been made by the
regional and village corporations to this extent, because I'm aware in Ketchikan and Saxman area, the Cape Fox Corporation and Sea Alaska, I believe, have made great efforts in this. And you mentioned the university, which really, from our perspective of folks down in Saxman, you know, that's fine. But doing it ourselves, Sea Alaska, Cape Fox Corporation, can you talk about how the different village and regional corporations have addressed this? There's no information that you didn't mention it in your opening. What are they doing? How does that work with your efforts?
Well, I know all of the native groups throughout the state have had this dialogue for a long, long time. And they've all had it on different levels and different spoken to it different ways. I think I don't think there's ever been an AFN convention where the issue of language has not come up. I just see this as being a means of just unifying all those voices and having them come together, so that we might address it in a more unified way. And also to because even as the native people speak amongst themselves, there's always the outside world that is, forgive me, passing legislation that's communicating something very different. So,
Mr. Chairman, just one
continue, please. Comment.
And that kind of gets to my mm-hmm. motivation for the question is, you mentioned the fact that an entire generation of Alaska Natives were literally physically harmed for using their language, an entire generation, and that's, in my opinion, where the language and that connection to the culture was lost. I mean, it was a horrible, horrible time. And I know many people who grew up living that, where there wasn't a white only in a, like the South, where it was white and black water, it was native and white, right? I mean, that actually happens. There's pictures of those places in Ketchikan. It's horrible. And that was implemented by the government. I mean, it was basically the institution of the government that basically was doing that and endorsing that through inaction. And then we've got the English-only legislation that you referenced that was imposed upon the culture by the legislature. And you articulated how the personal feeling of that one individual was when that happened, saying, oh, the legislature's doing this. And now we're going to have this, notwithstanding your intent and your connection and experience, but this is going to be implemented not from you, from the legislature. So I'm just wondering, rather than, and I'm not going to oppose this, but I just want to put step out there to think about, this is going to be handed down again from the legislature, and it just seems like when it comes from the native corps and the regional corporations, it has more buy-in from the people. And so that's just an overriding concern of another example of us just saying, okay, here you go. Now we're going to do this, and you're going to do it our way. And maybe someone will say, hey, I've been working on this for Cape Fox for 20 years, and now you're going to tell me how to do it? Kyle, white guy from the city.
Representative Dick.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe there's people waiting online that have way better answers for that than I do. So.
Thank you.
Yes. Representative Munoz, are you in the audience out here? You're welcome to join us at the committee table if you'd like. Okay. We could use a softening influence here. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make sure that the bill does for sure what you want it to do. And on page 2, the last two lines, the governor shall make the appointments required on or before December 1st of this year. Now, so the governor is going to make the appointments, and but up in here it says that the legislature will and make two appointments that are non-voting members. So this is going to be a permanent with permanent members that don't change except for the legislators. Is that your intent?
The chair, Representative Wilson, Annette Kreitzer again. Yes, that is the case.
Okay. Any follow-up? Okay. Representative Keller.
No, I'm fine.
Okay. Okay. Continue.
I think.
Okay. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just really didn't have a question as much as a comment. And having lived in a different culture and attempted to learn a foreign language, I became aware of how important that particular language is within the culture, and that understanding the language and learning to speak the language allowed you to get a different view and enabled you to understand that culture as well. And so I understand where this bill is coming from, and I'm hoping that we are able to do what you wanted to do, because I think your intention is well-founded and from the heart. So
I don't think it's possible, is it, to form a thought without using some language of some kind? I mean, how do we think without language? Does a baby think when they have no language at all when they're first born? Are they able to process things? Do they have to wait till they have some words with which to process a thing? How do any of us think without a language? And saying that, I would think that we take the same subject and maybe think about the same thing, but using different languages, you're going to get maybe a little bit different result. Because no two words mean the same, even within one language. And so I think when we think about matters such as we are here, you know, I'm thinking about this bill in English. Others may be thinking about this in other languages. And sometimes we get to the same result, sometimes we don't, because each word has different connotation. I grew up in East Los Angeles where Spanish was the predominant language. And so sometimes you get different results because you're not on the same page with these different languages. Representative Wilson, and then I'm going to get some of the folks in the audience here.
I know what you're trying to do, I think. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have a council, and the council is going to try to help all, and there all the different languages across the state work out so that each area can have their own language again. Is that what you're going to try to do? And then in the process of doing that, they're going to come and help. They're going to report to the governor and the legislature suggestions on how we'll be able to what?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the intent of the bill, really the council serves to look at what already is happening, as alluded to by Representative Johansson, what's going on in Cape Fox, for instance, and taking, as I understand it, best practices to recommend ways to perhaps support already existing policies. How can we support what's already going on at the university? How can we support and extend what's happening with Cape Fox? How can we look at how could the council look at and recommend cost-effective ways of supporting preservation, restoration, and revitalization of languages? It's a concept that the council will more broadly define as it goes along, but I think the framework is clear in the bill that the council will look at what's out there now, what's working. Certainly, I don't know that the council can be everything to everyone. I think as they review what is the work that is underway and whether they determine that they want to work on the EAC language first because it is the most endangered, or how they make that determination ought to be up to the council.
A follow-up?
Follow-up.
I guess I'm really wanting to know, are they going to try to tell the the governor and the legislature where to put money to help them do this, or are they going to, are they being developed to help their own groups figure out how to do this? Or, I mean, are they, bottom line, what are, do they want us to do?
The Chair, Representative Wilson, my understanding is that the establishment of the council, and again, as Representative Dick alluded to, there are other speakers who are waiting to speak who have very passionate opinions on this topic and what they think the council will do. But the council is established to elevate the discussion about the restoration and revitalization of native languages, first of all. And how they accomplish that, they will advise the governor and the legislature. The governor and the legislature, you know, I think, with all due respect, will listen to the advice and recommendations and make those decisions, if there are decisions to be made, in accordance with all of the other decisions that you have to make and all of the other advice that you and the governor receive. So I don't think that there's any greater expectation of this council than any other council that's out there with regard to, they'll come in with a specific funding request. They may not. They may ask for support of existing programs, whether that means visibility on the behalf of legislators to support or the governor, or whether that's a specific fiscal request. I don't think we can predict that right now.
Okay. Representative Drannan, I'm going to cut off here for a moment so I can get some folks online. Representative Johansson.
I just wanted to point out on page 2, specifically it says the council shall advise the governor and legislature on programs, policies, and projects. So they're going to advise us on what's out there and what options we may have, and then it follows that will be provided, obviously, through a report of its findings and recommendations on or before January 1st of each even-numbered year. It's right there in the bill exactly what this is going to do. My question for the sponsor is, where did this come from? You're obviously very personally experienced with your wife and your upbringing with the language and what you've seen, and her being the youngest speaker. Is this something that just came out of your own life experience, or were you approached on this issue, or where did the motivation for the bill come from?
I think the answer is all of the above. There's a whole list of people who have shown their concern and support. It comes from 45 years of observation, as well as in Western Alaska, as well as this group of people here that I could give you this list, but there's certainly a long list.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Is Denise Morris online? Just stay there.
I'm online.
Yeah, thank you for calling in. Please give your name and affiliation and make your comments. I'd like to keep it limited to about 3 minutes because there's some folks in the audience here who would like to speak.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to my support, Call Field
54.
Chairman, my name is Denise Morris. I'm in Lunga, Ontario. Although I was raised to anchorage, my identity and connection to my home community of St. Paul Island remains strong today. I'm the president and CEO of the First Alaskans Institute, and as I indicated, I'm testifying today in support of House Bill 254. On behalf of First Alaskans, we extend a sincere thank you to the sponsors and co-sponsors, and its companion Bill 130. First Alaskans Institute is a statewide Alaska Native organization focused on advancing Alaska Native the next 10,000 years, and we work to empower the indigenous peoples of the land to ensure that we are involved in shaping and making the decisions that impact our lives. For us, revitalizing our Alaska Native languages is an important part of the restoration of healthy and thriving communities in Alaska, in all Alaska. We ask all legislatures to support this bill and vote in the affirmative to create the Alaska Native Preservation and Advisory Council. Some of you may ask why support the Alaska Native languages when there are so many different languages from across the state and across the world that are switching in Alaska, and a response to some of the questions that have been asked thus far, answers simple. All other world languages have a home. Countries which seek them, nurture them, and grow their complexity and nuance over time. But the only home the indigenous languages of Alaska have is right here. Alaska is their home. Our language contributes to the uniqueness of Alaska, the rich human diversity of our state and our nation. Given an opportunity to blossom, they nourish and enrich lives, they empower our voices, they build cultural continuity, and strengthen identity. In response also, currently today, there are only approximately 120 fluent speakers of the Wangan Mari's language, and unfortunately, most of them are over the age of 65. Our languages contain knowledge not available anywhere else in the world, especially in relation to the land it has grown and developed on. If we as Alaskans are to steward Alaska and our resources into the future for the common good and for the benefit of all Alaskans, then the language of Alaska Native peoples are crucial to this endeavor. I want to emphasize and acknowledge the importance of this legislative purpose of working to preserve and revitalize our endangered Alaska Native languages. And for the council to advise the governor and the legislature on how to do this. The compelling aspect of the council is that it will be able to take a broad look at what is currently being done, as well as what can be done and should be done, to arrive at either establishing or reorganizing programs and to make recommendations to the governor and to the legislature and other organizations that are also working to revitalize Alaska Native languages. This is a great way to utilize the strength and knowledge of current Alaska Native language champions to advance and nurture the revitalization movement here in the language home soil. And having Alaska Native people who speak, teach, and continually learn their native language and work for preservation, restoration, and revitalization are crucial for the council's success. And I know there was a question asking what other entities and organizations are doing, and I just want to say that the Alaska Native Heritage Center, the regional corporations, the village corporations, the tribal corporations were all involved in some critical way in revitalizing and continuing the preservation of the Alaska Native languages that are so important to the Alaska Native people and all people across the state of Alaska. And there is ongoing programs and cultural camps, and it's that elders and youth conference every year that First Alaskans host. We have language workshops. So there is a real vitalization within the Alaska Native community to preserve the languages. In closing, I also want to encourage and request that the resources needed to implement the establishment of this council and its ongoing activities be accordingly allocated and appropriated. Again, it is with excitement over the funds contained in this bill that our languages are vital to our success and that of our children and to the health and welfare of Alaska overall, and request full legislative support of House Bill 254. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Did you say you were for Savunga on St. Lawrence Island? Is that correct?
No, I'm from St. Paul Island, the Pribilof Island.
Oh, the Pribilof. Okay. I appreciate your testimony. We got it. It's difficult to understand because it's a very bad telephone connection on the thing, so I would invite you to please send in your written testimony on what you just said so we can review that again. But thank you for calling in. Annette Smith, are you online? Annette Smith?
Yes, Representative Lynn and members of the committee. Koyana Nichuk Niluchi, Winga Pishaki Alhuak, Nuyang Alhugut, Atam Koyanchi, Zanazun, Mechlach Nichlas Uze, Duhun Gesaka, Hechta, Annette Evans Smith Seasney, Ina Ah, Carol Evans Buuze, Ita Ah, Richard Evans Buuze, Ina Ah, Bedesaka, Annie Zimmons, yes, Carva Zimmons, Heal An, Ita Ah, Bedesaka, Kitty Evans, yes, Peter Evans, Zalea, Blethenis, Hoots, and Sedantlet, Dehun, Anchorage, Lado. I introduced myself both in Yupik and in Koyukon, Athabascan. My name is Annette Evan Smith. I am the president and CEO for the Alaska Native Heritage Center. I am from South Naknek on my mom's side and Rampart on the Yukon River on my dad's side. I'm here to testify that many believe the DNA of our cultures exists within our language. With the loss of language comes loss of vast amounts of traditional knowledge. Our languages make our state unique also. They tell our story of our state. It is critical that we take proactive measures now to strengthen our languages while language speakers in each of the Alaska Native language groups still exist. An interest and aspiration to revitalize our languages for future generations is strong. Compelling evidence exists that links Indigenous children who have strong traditional cultures and linguistic backgrounds with academic success, overall wealth, and overall well-being. Languages fill a vital role. They promote strong cultural identity, and knowledge leads to strong cultural identity. Children taking language and culture classes benefit by gaining stronger identities and knowledge and appreciation of their heritage. The reverse of this is also true. American Indian and Alaska Native teenagers who are more conflicted about their culture are at greater risk for engaging in higher risk activities like alcohol and drugs, like dropping out of school. The Alaska Native Heritage Center's nationally award-winning after-school program and internship program have reached their highest graduation rates ever, and we concentrate on culture and heritage, and we have seen success in working with young people in this way. The graduation rate for Alaska Native students in Anchorage School District usually hovers around 43%. The kids in our program graduated a rate of 83%. This is an incredible difference when we make a connection to youth and their heritage. They make better choices and they're more resilient. At our core, we recognize that Indigenous language learning promotes increased self-esteem and confidence for our youth, and a strong cultural identity and knowledge translates into a stronger person overall. The Heritage Center is currently working to develop on-site programs to provide Indigenous language and learning opportunities in a full immersion environment.
Could I ask you to summarize? We have about 3 minutes, 4 minutes left. I have some in the audience here that would like to speak before we must close out because of the clock. It's what they call the news business a hard break.
Okay. I'll just reference that there are successful examples that have reversed and or restored Native Indigenous languages. You can look at New Zealand, the Kahangareos, the Punaleos in Hawaii, and the Arapaho Immersion School in Wyoming. This bill will help to unify our programs to restore Alaska Native languages, and it will provide the much-needed political infrastructure as well as human and financial resources to build and follow policies within and outside the state government to perform promote sustainable Alaska Native language efforts. I would like to thank Representative Dick and Representative Munoz for sponsoring this bill. And again, thank you, Representative Lynn, and members of the House State Affairs Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, and good morning. And I hope you'll send the spelling in the first part of your testimony for our clerks over here. Representative Keller, Quicklin?
Oh, no, let's go ahead.
Okay, I'd like to call... Rosita Roll, I think that's right. Are you here in the audience? I apologize for having to rush you a little bit. They kick us out of here at 10 o'clock, and it's about 1 minute of.
We'll fight for the time to stay here. Thank you for this opportunity to testify in behalf of HBL 254. My English name is Rosita Wuerl, and I serve as president of the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, whose mission is to perpetuate the Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian cultures. And our goals are to support cultural diversity and also promote cross-cultural understanding. SHI has been engaged in language restoration for the last 12 years. I'm also on the board of directors of the Indigenous Language Institute and a member of the National Council of Native American Languages. I am also an anthropologist with a PhD from Harvard University, and one of my minors was in sociolinguists. I have prepared a written statement on Alaska Native Languages and a report on Alaska Native Language programs administered by Alaska Native organizations that I will leave with you. My statement outlines the need for the legislation, and the report demonstrates that Native organizations are successful in implementing Native language revitalization programs. However, they are sorely, sorely minimal, and much more is needed to be done. To respond to Representative Johansson's a question about professional language expertise, I do believe that we have that within the state. I think the report that I am distributing to you will show you that we have Native people who are engaged in language restoration throughout the state. In honor of my ancestors and in respect to this committee, I am privileged to tell you who I am. Yadek Litzak, Kakahani Aksai, Shangu Kwedi Kajak, Nachatsati, Kaudli Yayi Hit, Ayachat, Sukakhadi Yadi, Ayachat. My Tlingit names are Yedeklitzak and Kahani. I am of the Thunderbird clan and the Eagle Moiety. I am from the house lowered from the sun in Klakwan, and I am also a child of the Sockeye clan. My Tlingit names embody my social identity and my cultural values. They establish a bond between me and my ancestors, and they also create for me a responsibility to our future generations. My social identity reflects our worldview and our relationship to the land and environment. I will share with the committee that it has taken me many years to resolve the conflicts between my native self and myself in the non-native world. I am of the generation of Alaska Natives who were forcibly, and I say forcibly, taken, or rather kidnapped from my homes and put in a mission school to be educated and to be civilized. That was the goal of the mission school that I was put in. Unfortunately, the conflicts that many of our young people experience today between living in a native world and the non-native world continues. I sincerely believe that this legislation can do much to move us towards understanding cultural differences and hopefully protecting linguistic and cultural diversity. I would first like to outline the status of Alaska Native languages. Unless remedial action is initiated, most all of Alaska Native languages will join their already extinct linguistic relative, the EAC, within a few short decades. According to a UNESCO report on endangered languages, Inupiat in the North Slope and Kotzebue and Gwich'in Athabascan languages are severely endangered, meaning that their languages are spoken by grandparents and older generations. While the parent generations may understand Inupiaq and Gwich'in Athabascan, they do not generally speak these languages to their children or among themselves. Aleut and the Southeast Alaska Native languages are critically endangered, meaning that the youngest speakers are grandparents and older, and they speak the language partially and infrequently. Yupik is classified as vulnerable. This means that most children speak the language, but it may be restricted to certain domains, such as in the home. I note with deep regret that EAC is extinct. Some have suggested that the Alaska Native Language Preservation and Advisory Council may duplicate the work of the Alaska Native Language Council. I would like to assure you that this is not the case. It is important for the legislature to understand the difference between documentation and revitalization. The Alaska Native Language Center, which was established some 40 years ago, focuses primarily on the documentation of Alaska Native languages. While the study of Native language is important, documentation by itself does not lead to the restoration of a language. Documentation does not include the development of curriculum or the training of Native language instructors, which are the two critical components in language revitalization. I believe that the legislature fully understands the social and economic costs to a society and to the state when a significant percent of its population has a poor education. Children growing up with the perception that their language and culture are inferior more often develop low self-esteem. And studies have revealed that low self-esteem is a major factor in failure at school.
We're going to have to wrap it up very quickly, please.
Surely. Anyway, Mr. Chair, I know that, you know, I'm trying to respond to some of the questions that I heard I asked
now,
here.
We're going to have another. And do you live in Juneau?
I do live in Juneau, Mr. Chair. And I just want to say, if I have to close, that native language restoration is not only good just for the language itself, but it is good for the society as a whole. It will help to improve academic achievement. And we spend millions and millions of dollars on a failed educational system for Alaska Native people. Our studies have shown that integrating language and culture into our educational curriculum improves academic achievement. Our efforts have been not only to restore the language, but also to improve the academic achievement of our children. And our studies of our programs have demonstrated that. However, I would like to point out that while I support this bill, I think it's a good bill in terms of moving forward to really identify the barriers to language restoration. There is far much more that needs to be done, and in my opinion, should be done immediately. Our languages are...
We're going to have another hearing. We're going to have another hearing.
All right.
And you are invited.
I invite you to read my testimony, Mr. Chair.
We'll be happy to do it.
Well, outline.
I appreciate you coming in, Doctor. And we're going to have another hearing on this, and I would, especially since you're local, I would invite you to come back in, and since we have cut you off here, continue your testimony, what you didn't get to say this time. Fair enough?
I would just encourage you to read my report. I think it's all in there. Thank you very much, and good luck to you, and I hope this is successful. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Our next scheduled State Affairs meeting is Tuesday, February 21st, 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. We'll be considering HB 304, Alaska Fire Standards Council, HJR 34, Coast Guard Icebreakers and Arctic Base, and we will attempt to look at bills previously heard, which would be Senator Cockhill's bill and probably Representative Dick's bill, if we can work it in. Thank you very much for sticking with us. We are adjourned.